Good evening and welcome to Weston United Methodist Church. My name is Reverend Brandon Baxter and I'm one of the associate pastors here at Weston. And we're happy to have you join us tonight for our hybrid series, Centering Your Week, where each week we gather here on Wednesday evenings at 6:15, either in person in the four-story theater or wherever you are with us in your home or somewhere else that is comfortable that you can be online. And we spend a little time checking in, hearing and exploring and praying through the different things of God and what it is that God is doing in the world around us and what it is God may be calling us to. And we follow this pattern every week of word, wisdom, wonder, and way. And tonight, we are at the end of the month, so we're at way, where we are looking. I invite somebody to come and join us that can help us either think about ways that we do the work of Christ in the world, or ways that we show care and compassion in the world, all of those things. And so tonight I am most pleased to have Lindsay Crinks with us. And I'll let Lindsay give you her titles and how she would like to introduce herself in that way. But Lindsay works for Open Table Nashville and is now a street chaplain, I think is what you would call yourself. Is that correct?
Yes.
So she is a street chaplain who works with Open Table and works with those who are experiencing homelessness. And she is going to walk us through a chat of her book that she has just published in the last year called Praying with Our Feet, Pursuing Justice and Healing on the Streets. And it's really both a memoir and a history of what's been going on in terms of advocacy on behalf of those on, I guess you might say, the underside of the city. I think that's kind of how Lindsay describes it. But I'm going to turn this over to Lindsay. She's going to share a little bit about her work, why she wrote the book, and share some passages from the book. And then she and I are going to spend some time in discussion about that. So, Lindsay, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Brandon. I know most of the people that are with us tonight are joining online, but whenever I'm at West End UNC, I always feel like I'm among kindred spirits. So many of you have journeyed with us so closely for so many years, and it's just a joy and a gift to be with you tonight. I'm one of the co-founders of Open Table Nashville, and for the last 15 years, I've been working on what Brandon mentioned, what we like to call the underside of our society, the streets of Nashville, the underpasses, the slums, the tent cities. That is where we find God moving. When I wrote Praying with Our Feet, I wanted to write the book I wanted to and wish I would have read 15 years ago when I was getting started in this work. As Brandon mentioned, it's an incredibly immersive and raw spiritual memoir about over a decade of this work. Over a decade of trying to learn not just what it meant to be in service with people on the streets, but to live in community and solidarity with them, which is a big part of our work at Open Table, shifting from just service to modes of solidarity. And it's really a memoir about risk and trauma, of faith and doubt, of being silenced and also finding my voice. I'm often asked what the typical day in the life of a homeless outreach worker is or a street chaplain is. I know you talked to Susan recently, one of our outreach workers that you support at West End, and I know she probably talked a little bit about that. But instead of just telling people what that looks like, I wanted to invite you on the streets with us to the outlawed encampments across our city where people are fighting for survival. I wanted to invite people to the front line of social justice movements that I've been a part of over the years. I think today or yesterday was actually the 10-year anniversary of my first arrest at Occupy Nashville, so I write about that in the book and take people to the front lines of that struggle. But I also wanted you to meet the prophets and pariahs that I have met on the streets over the years and the margins of our society that have radically transformed my life. I truly believe that if our lives as Christians don't look like good news to the poor, good news to the outcast, to those who are marginalized and caged and cast out in our society, if our lives don't look like good news to them, then we have to examine and ask what kind of God and what Christ we are following. You know, what does it look like to not just preach and teach the gospel, but to try to embody it with every fiber of our being, to live it out in the public sphere? I know you at West End have some experience in this because I know your hearts and I know what you've been up to, some of what you've been up to for so much time. But I also knew that, you know, if we were going to talk about this work in faith communities of not just doing the charity, but of framing our work in the justice realm that the prophets talked about, that Jesus talked about, that our churches and faith communities needed better tools. So this book has been a really great tool that a lot of faith communities have relied on. It's got a discussion guide in the back that was really fun to put together. And so it's really great if you have a small group or a class or something like that. The last thing I want to say about this book is, before reading a little excerpt, is that a lot of us have come to the understanding that our faith was never meant to be lived out in the private sphere of personal morality alone. Our faith is meant to be lived out in the public sphere. Jesus was not crucified because he was spiritual, because he was a Jewish mystic. Jesus was crucified because he came to usher in a different kind of kingdom that was a threat to the status quo, to empire. He came to usher in a kingdom where the poor are blessed, the hungry are filled with good things, the captives are freed both in the afterlife and in the here and now, and we are called to follow suit. Our faith calls us into all the places in our world today where there is suffering, where there is injustice. And our faith is calling us not just to pray with our hearts and our lips, which we absolutely do. It's also calling us to pray with our hands and our feet. After a quote that I had heard years and years ago by Abraham Joshua Heschel, Rabbi Heschel, who talked about his feet and legs praying and uttering songs and worshiping as he marched along Dr. King and Selma. So this idea is something that has really driven the last 15 years of my work, and it's been really fun to write about. I think you won't be disappointed if you pick up the book. So I want to read you a couple excerpts. One of the themes in the book is really, really unlearning the things society teaches us about how we are successful and we matter when we go, when we like dive into upward mobility, to making ourselves better and greater and shinier and more secure and all of that stuff. I find God on the streets and in the margins. And I want to read an excerpt from the chapter four called Downhill. Behind the brick and rock-faced exterior of my childhood church stood a playground made of wood and primary color plastics. The playground at that Church of Christ congregation was nestled in the rolling foothills of South Carolina. There was a cherry red slide, a swing set, and monkey bars that all kept watch over a hill that sloped sharply down some 40 feet to a creek. On one side of the water was a strip of shrubs and trees, and on the other side was an embankment that climbed up to a fenced-off highway. After each Sunday service, my church friends and I would race out back to play while the grown-ups mingled inside. One day, my friend and I laid flat at the top of the hill, folded our arms across our chest, and rolled down, tumbling recklessly over dandelions and clover. Halfway down the hill, we rolled sideways and came to a stop, our hearts pounding, heads dizzy, giggling at the pieces of dried grass in our hair. Our parents had told us to stay away from the creek. The hill was our border. Uphill was good and safe. Downhill was bad, off limits. But who on earth hasn't broken a rule? That Sunday, my friend and I crept down to the bottom of the hill in grass-stained dresses, dizzy with defiance. We peered through the trees and tiptoed near the creek's edge on a flat rock shelf. A canopy of green crowded out the light. As our eyes adjusted, our focus fell on a clothesline fixed between two trees. On the line were freshly hung mismatched socks, a yellow t-shirt, small Pepto-Bismol pink shirt, and blue checkered button-up. A rush of adrenaline flooded my senses. We are not supposed to be here, I thought. Come on, I said, pulling my friend's arm. Come on. And up we ran. I still don't know who called that narrow patch of woods home. All I know is that I was told that the creek and whatever, whoever, was down there was unsafe. I was told to stay away. I never saw their faces, never looked anyone in the eye. Did anyone from our church? Sometime after seeing the clothesline, I remember coming to church one Sunday to see that the brush and trees downhill had been completely cleared. I couldn't believe it. The earth next to the creek was bare, the clothesline a distant memory. Did someone at the church clear the area to run people off? What happened to the people and their belongings? Later, as an adult, I would hear that some church members justified the brush removal as a marketing ploy, a way for the church to have greater visibility from the highway. But the takeaway for me as a child was a feeling of separation. On the one hand, I was taught that God loved and welcomed everybody. But on the other, I was taught to fear and avoid people who didn't look and smell like me. What kind of lessons are we teaching in our churches? That's a rhetorical question, not in the book. I think you're asking the same things here with the hospitality work you're doing. I want to jump a little further in the chapter to a section called The Multitudes. This is happening, you know, that's a flashback to my first experience with the homeless encampment as a young child. But then this moving forward, I talk about my first year doing outreach work. As the weeks unfurled into months, a new litany of friends lived in my heart like a prayer. Candy, Lily, Kathy, Kentucky. I met Candy at Room in the Inn's Foot Clinic. The clinic was a brainchild of Jeannie Alexander and Rob Nash, a gentle and devoted nurse practitioner with endearingly corny jokes. As I cared for Candy's feet, she told me that she was raped as a child and was still trying to make sense of it. I suppressed it till I was 40, she told me, gripping her cross necklace, and then I broke. I heard stories like hers every week as we washed feet, scrubbing dead skin with pumice stones, clipping gunky yellow-brown nails, and massaging calloused, mangled soles. After a few weeks, maybe months, I got over the smell and shock. Seeing people's feet revealed the severity of their condition, a condition that festered in the cracks of a system upon which others built wealth. After weeks, months, and years without care, a person's feet wither, rot, harden, and decay while their body is busy surviving. Dry socks, foot spray, and a comeback next week sometimes felt like all we could offer people like Candy. But perhaps there was more. I knew from the first feet I washed that there was something sacred about scrubbing off the grime, sloughing off dead skin, and getting new calluses on my hand from trimming their thickened nails week after week. There was something holy about working their arches until my own hands ached. Had not others done this for me? The next week, I met a bright 2-year-old named Lily and her mother, Kathy, a single mother on disability abandoned by the child's father. Kathy had no safety nets or family support. When most people think of homelessness, they level accusations that people are on the streets because they choose to be, because they made bad decisions. If the homeless are hobos, junkies, and bums, wrote Jeannie in the contributor, then I guess you could call Lily the littlest bum. When the general public pictures somebody on the streets, they imagine a shabby older man, perhaps a vet with PTSD, pushing a cart. Lily was as far away from the stereotype as you could get, beaming, sober, innocent. Yet the fastest growing demographic of people experiencing homelessness, both in Tennessee and across the nation, was not self-medicating vets. It was families with children, and it still is. And then there was Kentucky, the stereotypical homeless guy, the hippie-loving, train-hopping, bandana-wearing, PTSD-riddled Vietnam vet who did push a shopping cart around East Nashville and slept on church stoops. Kentucky's buggy held a single crutch and several plastic bags with piss-yellow antiseptic mouthwash. He drank to drown his trauma and shame. Mouthwash was, after all, cheaper than liquor, and you could buy it without an ID, which I soon realized. I keep filling myself with this stuff, he told me one day. I know I'm hurting myself, but I don't know what else to do. Kentucky loved to tell me stories about all the church buildings he had wandered into over the years. Something always drew him to the churches. It was as if he gravitated to the possibility of healing and forgiveness, but couldn't allow himself to receive such grace. He didn't deserve it, he told me. He had done too much. The closest I ever got to being baptized, he said one day with a gummy grin, was when I stumbled into a church one night when it was real cold. I was looking for a place to sleep, and without knowing it, I climbed down into the baptistry. The next morning, I woke up on the other side, soaked from my waist to my boots. He told me another story about spending the night on the pew of an unlocked Catholic church. Just before the morning mass, a man woke him up to invite him in to stay for the service. "Nah," said Kentucky as he gathered his coat and stood up to leave. On his way out, he took a few long gulps of water from a bowl because his throat was parched. The man ran over to him and stopped him. "Don't you know what that is?" he said. "Nope," Kentucky replied. "That's holy water," he exclaimed. Kentucky shrugged. Gradually, the man's offense melted into a smile. "Well, at least you're filled with the Holy Spirit," he said, patting Kentucky on the back. I marveled at this. Despite Kentucky's unwillingness to accept grace, it was as if grace was pursuing him. I want to read two more paragraphs from the end of the chapter that comes back to the downhill a little bit. Because I was taught to stay uphill by my church, by the faith leaders that I knew, by my parents, by society. Through my friendships with people like Smurf, Candy, and Kentucky, I was learning to let go, to trust God, and to open my hands a little wider to my neighbors. I was being saved from myself and a wayward society that told me my worth was bound up in what I accomplished, accumulated, and possessed. I didn't know then that the coming years on the streets would both hollow and heal me, but I knew where I had to be. Down the hill, down the footpath, beneath the underpass, my healing would come from my wounds. It would come from community. It would come from below. So thanks for indulging some of that chapter. I hope you enjoy the rest if you pick it up. There's also an audiobook, not narrated by me. I was actually about to have my baby when I was finishing this up, and they were kind enough to get a professional voice person, so that is available if you like to listen there. But that's a bit about the book and a bit about me, so I'm excited to have a conversation with Brandon now, and just really thankful for the opportunity, so thank you.
And I'll remind people, too, that I'm monitoring the online chat here, so if there's anybody that has a question for Lindsay or wants to know anything as we chat, I can let her know that if you put it in the chat on Facebook or live stream as well. Thanks for sharing, first of all, and for reading and for being here and for all the work you do. As I heard you talk there and as I thought about reading through your book, the first thing that comes to mind as you think about coming downhill, right, and being told to stay uphill is this notion of contested spaces. A lot of contested spaces in this book. Contested land where people can be or not be, where people are allowed to be by our society, and people may not have any place to go, but also contested spaces around churches, what it means for the church to try to step into this work in bold ways and not always knowing how to do so, or maybe finding it harder than they thought it would be, and challenging our assumptions about ourselves, and even the contested spaces of our own beings. I know that you write about coming to a sense of your own vocation and sense of being guided into this work in contested spaces, and learning where it was that you fit into all of this, into the life of the church, or outside of the life of the church, and into life on as a street chaplain. So I guess, first of all, I just ask you to just unpack a little of that journey. Like, you know, What has been this journey of working through this stepping into this work, finding that identity as a street chaplain within the midst of those conflicting spaces of church and society, of uphill and downhill, all of that?
I love that you talk about contested spaces, because that's a word we use a lot too. And what a better city to talk about contested spaces than Nashville, that's growing out of itself. It is not the city it has been for the people that it was for, right? But, you know, part of coming in, as a child, I grew up in the Church of Christ, and I'm deeply grateful for a lot of that upbringing. But I also took on a lot of internalized depression. So part of my journey was unlearning how to keep silent, and that I was supposed to be silent because God couldn't work through someone like me. The part of unlearning that came through seeing women in Nashville, like Becca Stevens, like Jeannie Alexander, like so many others, who were women leading spiritual communities. I was awestruck. I remember reading Barbara Brown Taylor for the first time and thinking, oh my gosh. And I remember reading Dorothy Day for the first time. Dorothy Day, who of course was a founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, she was a really big influence on me early on. And I could see a woman in the throes of a Catholic faith that of course also didn't have space for women to serve in certain ways, really pioneering a different way of being with people that wasn't just about charity, but really was about community and solidarity. So I think that really helped me. I really enjoyed getting to know what some of my friends endearingly referred to the Methodist churches as the Methodist Mafia, which of course I'm good friends with Ingrid. So I've really enjoyed getting to know the Methodist churches. But you know, finding your voice for the first long time, your voice shakes, right? When we step into a new way of life, a new calling, it's scary. It's really hard. So having mentors and having people that I could look to was really huge. Being in intergenerational communities with people like, you know, Father Strobel, like Charlie, you know, who has been a big mentor for me. But it also involves a lot of risk. My husband and I both share this work. Andrew works a lot on incarceration, especially the criminalization of race and poverty. And so we didn't always know that there would be a paycheck for us with where our calling was. For years, I worked odd jobs and things like that. So even though we're trying to work ourselves out of a job by ending the carceral system as it currently exists and ending homelessness, it's risky work. But when something's your calling, you pursue it even if you're working odd jobs, you know, even if you have to do things on the side to make it work. So I'm thankful that we have communities that have come to stand in the margins with us. I think it's Greg Boyle, Father Greg Boyle, who started Homeboy Industries in LA. I think he's the one that said, if we were all to stand in the margins with people, the margins would disappear. And I feel like that has, you know, the calling that I have is a deeply individual calling in one sense, but the larger calling of God to stand in the margins, to go there, to find Christ there, to see the stranger as Christ, is a calling that is a collective calling to us. And only if we are ever going to make progress, we're going to do it together. So I've also understood my calling is one that is lived out in community. And that is the only reason why I'm still able to keep doing this work, because of the community that stands with us, that we're not all having to carry it on our shoulders. But that's a little bit about maybe getting to a couple of things that you asked, hopefully.
Yeah, that's great. You know, I've been, as I read the book too, and you talk about calling, and you know, you said this is a very individual calling for you in one respect, but it's also a calling to all of us that claim the name of Christ. And again, thinking back to, I wrestled a bit with
in many ways, to do the work that you do, you found yourself pulled outside of the walls mm-hmm. of the church. And I thought about many people that go to churches like ours, and I thought, they'll read a book like this, and I'll be like, wow, she does awesome work. And I don't know if I can do that, and also I don't know where my church is and all of that. Do you have any words for us about that and sort of that interplay between church and the world?
Totally. You know, I think all of us, you know, a calling is a voice that we hear. And often that voice comes from within us, attached to our own personal histories and our story, but also is a voice, the voice of God within us, speaking the Spirit into our lives. And I think a lot of us, if for those of us that haven't yet found our calling, I think one of the invitations of this book is to have spaces in our lives that aren't completely full. Because when we fill up our lives so much, we can't hear that still small voice, right? So if we're in the place where we're struggling to find our calling in the work of justice, start praying dangerous prayers. Like, a dangerous prayer is, God, show me where you want me to be in this work. Open doors that I can get deeper into your kingdom. You know, solidarity begins with closer proximity to the poor and oppressed and in relationships. So I think doors, very dangerous doors, will open to us to be in more proximity. For those of us who don't have that individual call yet, make space. You know, do a silent retreat or create silence in your life where you can hear the voice of God in your own life. Because your calling is going to look different than mine. Your calling is going to look different than mine. We don't need, you know, 1,000 street chaplains. We need you to do spiritual formation with this body. We need our dentists, our lawyers, our housing providers. Like, we need our teachers and everyone else to be really, really doing the work. The work that we do at Open Table Nashville isn't just about housing justice, right? The work that we do at Open Table Nashville is the work of collective liberation. And that is the broader work that I see in the gospel. That is a broader work of getting us all free. And we all have a place in it. So we have to find that. But it is scary. It's challenging. It's not a work to be done alone, even when it is an individual call. I think we need to be asking, who is in this with me? Whether that's getting more involved in a group like Open Table Nashville or finding another place that kind of meets your calling. Who was it that said, where the world's... Your greatest calling or whatever is where the world's greatest need meets your gifts. Or I just butchered that quote completely. Somebody knows that quote that's better. But anyway, but yeah, I don't know. We have to be still and silent and create space for the Spirit of God to inform us. Mm-hmm. And that, I think that has to happen as a community too. And I know y'all have done a lot of that work. That's a spiritual formation work too, right?
That is. But we do, one of our great needs in this city right now is the work you are doing. And you, in this, if anybody that hasn't read this book yet, if you read it, you'll really get a little taste of some of the history of the last 10, 15 years in our particular city, if you are in Nashville or the surrounding areas, about the challenges, the real challenges we're facing right now. And you're right, you draw out stories of a lot of different people coming from a lot of different walks of life to build relationship and address what needs to be done. But can you kind of just in a brief way sort of walk us through sort of what some of those challenges are right now, like where we've been and where we are right now? Especially, I know you mentioned towards the end of the book, you have a little, I don't know what you'd call it, an epilogue, is that what it says? Mm-hmm. That says, you know, now things are even more different with COVID and everything else. But tell us a little bit about the challenges and the work that you and people that have come alongside you have been doing in terms of both relationship building, but also really working on the structures of of some of the issues related to poverty and homelessness and other things in our city.
Yeah, so one of the things that I really wanted to write about in this book was taking people behind the scenes of what it looks like when an encampment is facing closure by the city's hands, right? So there's, like, I take people to Tent City when it was facing closure, when it was washed out by the flood. I take people, a lot of people that have been in Nashville will remember Fort Negley and Mayor Barry trying to close that and eventually closing that. And that story, the backstory of that is in here. I talk about getting involved in tenants' rights with a slum in Madison where, you know, there were bed bug bites on the bellies of two-year-olds. I have a 15-month-old right now, and these mothers had nowhere else for their children. Everything that is in this book has been intensified in the last 2 years, especially in Nashville. Our city is closing encampments at the most rapid rate we ever have. There are, I think, 10 or 11 have already been threatened or closed this year. We've been able to keep a couple open, but others have just moved on. We just received a list of 13 or 14 other sites that TDOT, the Tennessee Department of Transportation, was about to close, along bridges and highways and interstates, that kind of thing. So we're looking at, this is a land struggle. You know, people have nowhere to legally exist, and there's no housing. So instead of providing housing to people, we're just pushing them deeper into their poverty and criminalizing their existence. In terms of affordable housing, we thought things were bad when I was living this book. Okay. The last study that came this spring from the Mayor's Affordable Housing Task Force report said that by 2030, we will have a deficit of 50,000 units of affordable housing in Nashville.
Affordable?
So that is affordable? 0 to 80% area median income. Mm-hmm. So like a lot of like teachers and stuff are around the 80 to 90%. So anybody that's making, and I can't remember the exact number, but 0 to 80% of area median income is like affordable housing that they're measuring. Most of those units that are at a deficit are in the lowest category, which is our people, of course. But if you think, it's hard to picture that number, but, you know, if anybody ever, I know most people probably have been to Bridgestone Arena. Bridgestone Arena holds 20,000 people when it's packed. So you're looking at, like, 2+ Bridgestone Arenas completely packed out. And if all of those people were housing units, that's what we would be facing a deficit of. And that is having real consequences. Our death rate on the streets is up higher than it ever has been. Last year was the highest number, and this year we're already going to pass that. So people's lives are literally hanging in the balance. At the same time, we have incredibly dysfunctional and toxic departments that are running things. And we are seeing, and we are a part of right now, a huge push to have an Office of Housing and Homelessness in Nashville that can be independent, that can be outside of political whims of mayoral changes, outside of departments that don't want to think innovatively and evidence-based and boldly about the situation we're in. We don't need any more studies about how many units we lack. We need a plan. So we're pushing for those kind of things. It's not just bad in Nashville. We know it's bad across the state. And in the spring, last spring, our legislators moved to make camping on public property across the state a felony offense. That was something we couldn't even dream of, like when I was living this. We just knew private property. People couldn't be on private property. But a felony for people that are sleeping out. So we were able to stop that bill, but we're anticipating it coming back up. So it's an incredibly hostile environment that we're trying to work in. We know what ends homelessness. It's housing and support. We've seen other cities make strides to ending chronic homelessness, and we know that we can. It's a dangerous belief and knowledge that we can do better. It's our priorities as a city, and it's the leaders' priorities. So we're working to change that. Hopefully people are following Open Table Nashville on socials, but that's one way to stay connected with some of the struggles that are happening today. Mm-hmm. All of us can look back at the civil rights movement and say, I would have been that good person. You know, maybe if we're white, I would have been that good white person, or I would have been involved in the marches, or I would have been on the right side of things. But which side are we on today? All of these injustices are interconnected. And if our lives don't look like good news to people who are oppressed, then again, I think we have to question what we're doing individually and collectively. And you know, good news doesn't have to mean that you become an activist overnight, right?
Yeah.
Good news can be as simple as smiling and making eye contact with the person that's, you know, asking for help on the median next to your home or on the off ramp as you're going back to work or something. Just communicating compassion instead of judgment, just carrying some things with you in your car, like the Good Samaritan was prepared, right?
Yeah.
He had the oil and wine to bind the wounds. So how can we be prepared to be good news, even a smile, just to affirm human dignity in those small encounters? That is good news. Also, we'd love for you to write your legislators with us in the spring, because that is also good news when people don't get a felony for sleeping out because the missions are full or they can't get in. So, we get into, I think, what John Lewis called good trouble at Open Table, and we know many of you do too. So hopefully we can keep doing that together.
Yeah. Well, you know, I love, though, you know, thinking back to sort of your story, I was hearing you talk about that, and I was thinking about how you found your calling over time by doing just that, by getting to know individuals, by starting to, I think there's a story you tell early in the book, I think, I guess you're in the sewers, is that what you're doing?
So it's the water pipes.
The water pipes?
Feed, it's underneath downtown Nashville.
Yeah.
You crawl through a grate, you pull up a grate, and you crawl down the ladder, and you literally walk between the hot and the cold water pipes that cool and heat all the downtown buildings. Mm-hmm. One of my friends at Lipscomb kind of was a danger person. He took me down there. But really, that's really seeing the city from below, literally.
But you write in the book, and this is one of the things that I think would be great for anybody that chooses to read it, to read kind of how you said that as you started to do things like that, started to see from underneath, and then also started to meet people. Smiling at people, talking to people, hearing stories, that called you further into this. It doesn't mean if we did that, we'd all end up doing what you're doing. But you said that you can't see the city the same way anymore.
Right.
What do you mean by that?
So I think I write in that passage, once you learn to see the city from below, you can't unsee it. Like, when I drive through the city, I see the homes that are created in the rafters of interstate underpasses. I see the footpath between the trees, right, and the brush off an interstate ramp or behind a gas station. That flash of blue tarp through the winter trees that you see. My eyes don't see the shine of Nashville. My eyes don't see the nice restaurants that we're getting, the big shopping centers and entertainment centers. My eyes see the people that I think Jesus would be drawn to, and I think that is a gift. And it's also a very weighted gift that I have been given, and I think many of us get, especially when we learn to see differently. But it's not, when you open your eyes to that, it's not just learning to see the city from below. It's also trying to understand history from the underside and below, the people that were crushed and didn't get to tell their stories, right? And it's also learning to see theology from below, and not just an overly spiritualized kingdom of God, but something that gets their feet and hands dirty in the muck of the world, like Jesus did. So I think, again, hopefully we can all have eyes to see both our city and the Bible, Scripture, Holy Word from below, because I think it will forever change us and make us have different priorities in our own lives. And in our own, in the things that we have, it helps us release our grip from everything we're holding to hold it with better open hands, I think.
Mm-hmm. How did the church and the world for you connect today? Because you talk a lot about if you read the book, Lindsay talks about being raised in the Church of Christ, having a relationship with a church that's not too far from where I live, that I'm familiar with and have friends that go there. And then over time being drawn out into a community of faith that you built with like-minded persons who were seeing the world in a different way. So where does that connect for you today?
It wasn't just that I think I was both drawn out of the church and pushed out of the church, right?
I think that's, yes, you're right to say that. Yes.
You know, and I think that story of being pushed out of the one particular church is in the book. That was a really painful experience. But my church today is the streets, but it's also part of the faith communities we work with. Andrew and I do attend some services here at St. A's, which has been a lovely space for us. And we were part of a contemplative justice service before the pandemic. But, you know, whenever I think there's a theologian, maybe it's Miroslav Volf, who says, when the church isn't seen and identified with the broken ones in society, the crushed ones in society, then the only response to the crushing can be condescending paternalistic charity. Mm-hmm. And so the churches that I'm drawn to today and that I feel kindred with, like y'all, are not just doing the charity work. You're in the trenches with us. You are having relationships. You are trying to extend further and build deeper. And that's what gives me hope. The church is going to look different today and 10 years and 20 years, 50 years down the road. It's probably going to be out in the community more. I hope it is. And at the same time, it's essential. We have to see it as a very important part of bringing the kingdom of God in the here and now.
Well, I'm glad you gently pushed me to say that you were pushed out in many ways of the church, because I think that's a reminder to us that it's really easy to push everything we're talking about out of the church, mm-hmm. right? I know even just today, I was navigating some issues around people who needed something from us, and mm-hmm. also the limitations of our space and other things we have going on here, like our preschool and things like that. And it's a tough thing to figure out when I appreciate that you say that about our community of faith, and at the same time, I hope that we are a community that is going to continue to try to get deeper mm-hmm. and think broader, because it is very easy to push, not only push out the prophets, but push out those that the prophets are called to mm-hmm. to be taken care of. Absolutely. And to be seeing. And so I appreciate that you said that. Check my time here. Oh, my goodness. We're already at about 7:00. I can't believe it.
That was fast. Hopefully, I know. It wasn't too slow for the people joining.
No, I think it was wonderful. Are there any final words or things that you would say to us tonight, or a closing thought you'd leave us with?
Solidarity begins with closer proximity and relationships. So maybe I'll go forth with discomfort at easy answers, and also this a dangerous prayer that we would be led deeper into the work of the kingdom of God, because I think that's where we will find our own salvation as well, in that work. At least that's been true of me.
I know we've got just 1 minute, but can you say a little more about that? Because I think sometimes people don't understand that or hear that. What do you mean by we find our salvation in that?
You know, to put it simply, when we read Matthew 25 about the judgment of the sheep and the goats, right? Who are the people that Jesus is calling sheep? Who are the people Jesus is saying, when you did this for the least of these, the folks on the bottom, you did this for me? I have found my own liberation, and it's kind of a co-liberation that happens in relationship. But I found my own sense of meaning and purpose and freeing up of all the things that kept me bound to the world through the relationships and the work of working toward justice. And in relationship with people that I consider Christ today. There's a longer story there, but that's what I would say. The life, I think Flannery O'Connor said, the life you save may be your own. She has that short story. The life you save may be your own work.
That's beautiful. The life you save may be your own. Lindsay, thank you so much for joining us. I hope everyone will check out Lindsay's book. And in fact, this is the copy from our own church library. So if somebody wants to come check it out from the library, you can come and read it right here at West End. But Lindsay, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Oh, thanks for
thank you, everyone that was here, both in person and online. And we will see you again next week when we start another cycle. We'll be back to the beginning again, where we'll be talking about the Word, and we'll look at some of the scriptures that we'll be focusing on for the next month. So have a blessed evening, and we'll see you next week.